You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong tokingua. E whakarongo ana koe ki te waia marunga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, te rā teko mā whā o whiringa anuku. Kia ora, you're tuned in to 95 BFM and this is the Thursday Wire. I'm Justin Wong, your host for today. For today's show, October 14th. E haere ake nei, coming up on the show today, we have our usual chat with Health Minister Andrew Little for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party. International Desk reports on the latest on cross-strait relations between China and Taiwan. And the government has announced the discussion document on the strategy to cut New Zealand's emissions to achieve net zero by 2050, but environmental groups and unions are not on board. As usual, here are our avocado. Let me know what you think. Tukapatuhi mai, the text number is 5395, or if you want to talk to me in person, the number is 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware, e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki eni kōrero anō hei pakihiri rokiroki maranga i te paitukutuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. As always, you can catch all these stories and other shows, music or other previous wires by podcast on the 95BFM website, and mine will be available just after 1pm. I tēnā wā tonu. Now let's head over to Wellington.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the grace period for medicinal cannabis ending at the start of this month, as well as the End of Life Choice Act, which is scheduled to come into force on November 7th. But I began by asking him about ICU capacity in the face of growing COVID cases. The Prime Minister has said 2 days ago that we could see a doubling of cases in the next 2 weeks. Is ICU prepared for this?
Yeah, so we have to remember too, there might be a doubling of cases, but only a small proportion of cases end up in hospital, and a smaller proportion still end up in ICU. So if you think about currently we have just under 550 active cases in Auckland and Waikato, mainly in Auckland. And of those, 28 of those are in hospital and 5 of those are in ICU. So there might be a doubling of cases, but it doesn't mean to say that hospitals and ICU are going to be overwhelmed. That's it. We've got to be prepared, obviously, to make sure that our ICUs do have capacity and that our hospitals do have capacity, and there's a big chunk of work going on that at the moment. But I'm confident that even if there were a doubling of cases, the health system would be fine.
Well, but in terms of numbers, how much ICU capacity is being used up so far?
Roughly 60%, or 60, I can actually give you the numbers, but it's 66%. So when we think about ICU capacity, and this includes designated ICU wards as well as beds that can that are stood up for ICU level care, so often described as high dependency care. So there's about, we sort of hover between about 325 and 340 of those. It changes from one day to the next across the whole hospital network because of what else is going on in a particular hospital and staffing and what have you. But so of those beds that can be used for ICU level care, roughly two-thirds are being used at the moment. And from one day to the next, we hover between kind of 65 and 70%. So that's about right.
Is that usual?
That's usual, yeah. I get a daily report. At 5 o'clock each day, I get a report on capacity utilisation across our hospital system. And I get specifically ICU utilisation ventilator, because some people in ICU and some people outside of ICU are ventilated. And the total number of beds across our system and the level of utilisation there. So ICU utilisation tends to hover between sort of 65 and 70%. The total hospital capacity utilisation hovers between about sort of 80 and 85%, and then ventilator capacity is usually under 20%. We have a lot of ventilator capacity, and we have a lot held in reserve in case, you know, in relation to COVID, there is a need for it.
But still, two thirds of our capacity being used up so far, that isn't a lot of wriggle room unless you have surge capacity.
So that it means that at any one time there's about 100 other ICU level beds that could be used. The other thing that is that you know, what we asked the hospital to do from the end of last year was identify what other beds could be converted into ICU level care or HDU care. Just, you know, because it's not, ICU beds are not just those in a designated ICU ward. It's having the right staff, the right equipment and space available. So the DHBs and the ministry tell me that if they needed to, they could surge up to 550 beds dedicated to that high level of care. Now that would mean you'd cancel all your surgeries, your planned care surgeries, your hip operations and things like that, if you had to. But we could get up to that level of care.
Well, the 515 number is for the entire country, right?
Yeah, well, so are the other numbers. I'm talking about the system as a whole. So you've got your big metropolitan hospital like the ones in Auckland. The one of the challenges we have is the smaller provincial hospitals that only have a small number of designated ICU beds. They can lift that capacity to some degree. But if there were a large outbreak in a provincial centre, it is possible, in fact probably likely, that some patients would have to be transported to other hospitals for care because the smaller hospitals would need to do that.
Okay, out of the 550 beds across the entire system, how many of them are in Auckland?
I couldn't tell you that, to be honest. I can't tell you that. At the moment, I mean, if I look at the figures for of the regular kind of roughly between kind of 325 and 340 beds, the number in Auckland are there's about 50 or 60 of those beds just in Auckland. This surging that up to 550, I think that will probably push it up to over 100.
Okay, moving on to my second topic of the day, it's on medicinal cannabis. Now, the grace period that allows manufacturers to meet the new safety standards of cannabis medicines ended a while ago at the start of this month. So how many applications made the final cut?
There's still quite a few applications actively under consideration, but there's a total of six products now available in the market. And that's a combination of CBD-only products and CBD and THC products. And of the two New Zealand manufacturers who've got their GMP license, they will be putting specific products through the application process or the approval process at the moment. So there'll be more products coming on stream in the next few weeks and months.
Well, but the application process was extended for twice, two periods of 6 months, so it's a total of 18 months, but only six products were approved. That's not a lot, is it?
There's a slight confusion there. So what was extended twice was the exemption period for products in the market having to meet the GMP standard, and whether they were imported or locally manufactured, all products were exempt from meeting that standard for a period of time. We extended it twice because it was taking local importers and manufacturers longer to get up to speak and get the data, all that sort of stuff. But I did, for the second extension, which was I made at the beginning of the year, earlier in the year, I said this would be the last extension because really everybody's had enough time to get the data they need and get these products sorted out. Some importers got on with it and got their products through the approval process and got it approved. Others have taken much longer, and although they've got applications in, they haven't got the approvals before the exemption has expired, so they can't put those products in the market until they get the approval. So the approval process is a standing process. Anybody can apply for approval of a product at any time, provide the data and all the rest of it, but the exemption for meeting the standard has now expired, so every product on the market now has to meet this standard.
Some of the manufacturers say the standards are way too high. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, we consulted widely with the industry before they were promulgated, and actually the industry said, we want the best possible international standard because we want to be able to export. The New Zealand manufacturers in this area want to be able to export because they probably quite rightly see the market in New Zealand isn't going to be that huge, and actually if they want to be commercially viable, they need to be able to go into bigger markets, and they would be ones overseas. So they wanted a standard that meant they could export easily. So the standard we've got is an internationally accepted standard. Other countries use it and manufacture according to it. So I don't get this thing that suddenly this is all too hard. It's what the industry wanted when we consulted with them.
Okay, going to my final topic of the day, a little quick touch on the End of Life Choice Act. Now, you said recently the health system is ready to implement the Act. What do you mean by that?
Oh, just that there were, once the referendum was approved, approved the legislation and it became enacted, it takes effect from the 7th of November this year. A few things had to be put in place. So there's a couple of oversight committees, the regulations had to be put in place, the fees regime for practitioners doing this sort of work had to be put in place. That is all now in place. So and information, so there's information on our website. So everything that had to be in place for the legislation to take effect on the 7th of November is now in place, and people who wish to avail themselves of their rights under this legislation from the 7th of November will now be able to do so. There will be practitioners available, there's advice available, and the legislation will be workable.
How many medical practitioners have you got on board to implement the End of Life Choice Act?
I understand from the ministry it's roughly 100 medical practitioners have registered their interest in being a practitioner offering this this sort of assistance and advice. I expect that that'll grow a wee bit. We know that there's mixed views and some strongly held views within the medical fraternity about all this. Some medical practitioners don't agree with it. Others consider it's just part of the dignity of the person and letting them make their choice. But the main thing is that there are practitioners who will be available to assist people who want to exercise their rights under the law.
I remember back during the euthanasia referendum, there was a concern that most of these medical practitioners were concentrated too much in the city, and it would means people living in areas that don't have these kind of services will miss out.
Yeah, I think there's a reasonable distribution of the practitioners who have expressed interest. But in the fees regime that we've set up, we've built in the fact that actually some people may need to rely on a medical practitioner who is some distance away. So the transport allowance provisions are, mean that a medical practitioner who has to travel some distance to assist a patient won't be out of pocket.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Ko te waia, tēnei marunga irirangi pōho. You tuned into the Thursday Wire with me, Justin Wong, on 95BFM, and that was Health Minister Andrew Little. The time is 18 past noon here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be back after a break.
Wow. Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
The October playlist features I Eat Crazy, Gelato Negro, Ma, JPEG Mafia and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Where in the world is Justin Wong. It's Overseas Experience, your international news update on 95BFM.
Cross-strait relations between China and Taiwan are tense once again as a record number of Chinese fighter planes entered Taiwan's air defense zone. China has long regarded Taiwan as a breakaway province and has long vowed reunification. This is repeated once again by Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing earlier this week during annual celebrations of the 1911 revolution that ended imperial rule in China.
The historic task of the complete reunification of the motherland must be fulfilled, and it will be fulfilled. Achieving national reunification by peaceful means best serves the interests of the nation as a whole, including our brethren in Taiwan.
Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen said in her National Day's address on October 10 that the country would not bow under pressure, and the path that China has laid out offers neither a free and democratic way of life for Taiwan.
The people of Taiwan will never give in to pressure. We'll continue to bolster our defense and demonstrate our determination to defend ourselves to ensure that nobody can force Taiwan to take the path China has laid out for us.
Earlier this week, I spoke to Canterbury University political science professor Alex Tan about the current situation.
Recently, we saw a record number of Chinese fighter jets entering Taiwan's airspace. Considering recently Taiwan's relation with several European countries are warming up, and there are military exercises by several Western states near the areas in Taiwan, do you think it's kind of a coincidence that this is happening, or it's a direct response by China?
I think, whether it's a direct response by China is hard to say. But we know that all of these exercises that we're seeing as part of the, the exercise done by the British, by the Japanese, the Quad, they're definitely there signaling that they want a free sea lanes of communication, right? I mean, the trade routes and what have you. China sending these planes towards Taiwan's air defense identification zone is a signal also that they are not just going to give this up, right? That it's also a reminder to not only the Taiwanese people, but the regional countries that China is intent on reunifying Taiwan. I don't know what the time frame looks like, but certainly they have not given up that intent.
Picking up on that, well, we've seen Chinese President Xi Jinping mentions that the mainland wants reunification with Taiwan regardless of what method. A couple of times before, since Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen's election in 2016. Do you think it's just the repeat of the same pattern, or is this more of a more legitimate threat now?
Well, I think there are two things. It's more of the same, but it's definitely ramping up. That's what we're seeing. Since 2016, when the Democratic Progressive Party won the presidency again, there has not been really very substantive contact between China, PRC, and Taiwan. So, because this current government in Taiwan have not really acknowledged the so-called 1992 consensus, right? The idea that there is one China, but with two different interpretations. This current Taiwanese government doesn't even, subscribe to that or buy into the 1992 consensus, so to speak. So whatever the mainland has been doing, the more recent speech by Xi Jinping did not mention use of force. But in a way, actions are louder than words sometimes. And leading up to that speech wherein he calls for a peaceful reunification between the PRC and Taiwan, you know, just a couple of days before that, you know, the PLA has been sending, you know, lots of airplanes close to, you know, in Taiwan's air defense identification zone. So, yeah, definitely it's a both carrot and stick approach. But definitely, in a way, it's also showing that China is increasingly having that capability to be able to be a disruptive force in the stability of the current status quo, the current status quo and stability of the Taiwan Strait.
Could it go horribly wrong?
Of course, definitely. I mean, it could go horribly wrong by accident, because of the mishaps that can happen, you know. Just imagine with such crowded skies, for example, the possibility of collision, mid-air collision, or worse, a trigger-happy pilot that shuts down an opposing airplane. And that could lead to a war, you know, as a result. And as you can see already, you know, crowded seas in the South China Sea also can lead to miscalculation wherein ships collide or, you know, certain things happen that is really not in the, not planned, but really accidental. Of course, it can go horribly wrong on both sides, right? And on any side. And that's one reason why, you know, this idea of, you know, when you're playing with fire, you'll get burned. So that's essentially what it is. So if we don't want to get burned, well, let's not play with fire. And I think China's playing with fire.
On the same time that Taiwan is also putting, I think, $9 billion, putting a lot more money on its defense. So is it safe to say that these tensions won't be going away anytime soon?
Well, I don't think it will go any away anytime soon. I think when you think of China putting $9 billion and compared to the hundreds of billions that, Taiwan putting in $9 billion and the hundreds of billions that the PLA has been upgrading its military, Taiwan definitely needs to provide security for its own people. As you know, as you well know, many of the, you know, neighboring countries do not have formal diplomatic relations with Taiwan. So Taiwan is really left to its own defenses. And if it cannot defend itself, then, you know, how can it expect others to defend it? So in a way, Taiwan's spending, increasing its defense spending is just, you know, logical in response to the increasing threat from the PRC, and you know, Taiwan's main existential threat is from the PRC, and when the PRC is growing, its military is growing that much, Taiwan has no choice but to keep up and make sure that it has enough deterrent force to let the PLA think twice before it launches an all-out offensive on the island.
Overseas Experience with Justin Wong, only on 95BFM.
And that was International Desk. And of course, that was Canterbury University Political Science Professor Alex Tan, who spoke to me yesterday about the latest cross-strait relations between China and Taiwan. It's 28 past noon here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be back after another break, but now here's some bits for you.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Welcome back. Environmental groups and unions have said the government's discussion document on New Zealand's plan to become net zero by 2050 focuses too much on cutting transport emissions and instead letting agriculture and energy emissions off the hook. The government released its draft emissions reduction plan yesterday, 4 months after receiving the final advice from the Climate Change Commission, and transport will see the biggest shakeup. The draft plan wants to cut the number of people travelling by car by 20% by 2035. There is also a target to grow the number of zero emissions vehicles by 30% by 2035, and it will be sped up by paying those on low income to replace their high emission vehicles with an EV and a charger. Other incentives include cutting organic waste being sent to landfills and developing new biofuels and hydrogen fuels. Greenpeace campaigner Christine Rose said the plan is not stepping up action on climate change and instead it's, quote, hot air and utter bullshit. I spoke to her earlier this morning and I started by asking why.
Well, it's mainly because our main climate polluter barely gets a mention in the document. And so it's a real oversight and a disappointing abrogation of responsibility. There are just a couple of references in the document to agriculture despite its significant impact on the climate. And so it's really not worth the paper it's written on.
So but what should be done in regards to agriculture if it isn't doing enough?
At the moment, the suggestions in the document are that the government investigate techno fixes and do more engagement with farmers, when we know that by eliminating synthetic nitrogen fertiliser and lowering cow stocking rates, we could immediately take the foot off the throttle and address a significant amount of climate change emitting greenhouse gas emissions. So addressing agriculture has to come first, and to do that, the simple solution is to remove those harmful inputs, particularly synthetic nitrogen fertiliser, and move towards regenerative organic agriculture that doesn't require those inputs and is much kinder to the earth, to our water, to animals and to farmers.
Considering other emissions like transport is also important, why should agriculture go first?
Well, at the moment, agriculture is being given a free ride. So it's important that other sectors meet their emissions issues as well. The report talks about it being a plan for all New Zealanders. So the fact that agriculture is missed out means that it's all New Zealanders except industrial dairy. So, sure, address all the other issues, and the response from other sectors is that even in transport and other sectors, it doesn't go far enough, but it certainly doesn't even scrape the surface when it comes to agriculture.
Well, the final emission, because this is only a consultation document, the real emissions reduction plan is supposed to be released in December, but it has been pushed back by 5 months. In May next year. Are you disappointed to see this?
Yeah, it's not really dealing with the seriousness of the issue. It's a climate crisis. The government's agreed on that. It's our nuclear-free moment. The Prime Minister has made a big deal about that. And so given that it's a threat to our existence and that we have pushed the world's planetary boundaries when it comes to climate change, biodiversity loss and the nitrogen cycle, and all these things are completely linked to industrial dairying and agriculture, why would we not address those issues? So, but there has been this pattern through the years of giving a free pass to dairying, and that's continued with this document, and so it looks to continue in the ultimate emissions reduction plan.
And that was Christine Rose from Greenpeace talking to me about what she thinks about the government's emissions reduction plan discussion document. Forrest and Bird also said the government hasn't acted like there is a climate emergency, and the plan did not mention much on energy emissions or a nature-based approach. I spoke to their strategic advisor, Jeff Key, this morning.
We were very disappointed. I mean, the Prime Minister is basically going to have to crack the whip on the ministers and tell them to get on with the job.
Why is that?
There's so much missing that should have been in there. And yeah, they've got until May to finish the job, but there's no plan for restoring native forests. There's no plan to protect wetlands. There's no plan for pest control. There's no plan to end coal mining. So, you know, it's just business as usual, and it's not acceptable.
But what about the other aspects that was mentioned in the plan, such as reducing transport emissions?
I mean, I'll give them credit in one particular, in a couple of areas. Waste, they put a lot of work in, and on transport, they put a lot of work in. But, you know, nearly half our emissions are from agriculture. Transport got over 30 pages, which is a sign that the Transport Ministry did their work, did their homework. But, you know, 4 pages on agriculture. So, you know, MPI appears to be asleep at the wheel here. You know, the Ministry of Primary Industry should be putting in a lot more about what we can do to cut agricultural emissions, what more we can do to restore forests, and what we saw presented yesterday was very disappointing.
And the energy policy, you said you also want to see more reductions in coal mining?
Yeah, the whole energy sector seems to be kicking the can down the road, really. What we need to see is not some talk about some kind of future plan, but actual decisions now. So we need to see an end to new coal mining. I mean, you can't continue to mine coal, sell it, and burn it, and think you're doing anything to solve climate change. So, you know, we have to stop coal mining. We also need to see what's the plan for renewable energy. You know, where new renewable energy gets put is really important. You know, it could be done well, it could be done really badly, and we're going to need a lot more of it. There's no plan for that.
You also mentioned something about conservation. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, so the government, when they started the process of developing an emissions reduction plan, and to be clear, this is not the plan yet. This is just, you know, they're putting their ideas out for discussion. But one of the things they said was that nature-based solutions would be a key part of the plan. That's things like protecting forests, protecting wetlands, you know, the places that store a lot of carbon. And there's just nothing in there. But there's no... The word wetland, I did a search on the document, I could not even find it in the document, let alone a plan to protect them. You know, and we have a ridiculous situation now that while there's no plan to protect them, the Ministry for the Environment is talking about allowing new coal mines to destroy wetlands. So that's like the complete opposite of tackling climate change. You know, destroy a store of carbon and put it into the atmosphere and then do it to dig coal to put more CO2 into the atmosphere. It's like the antithesis of tackling climate change.
Okay. The government also said it's quite unlikely for New Zealand to meet its first emissions budget in 2025, but that can be balanced out in the long term because of more native forests to act as a carbon sink. What do you think of that?
Well, that might be plausible if there's actually a plan to do that, but there's really nothing in there that tells us that they have a plan to restore native forests and to do more pest control and all the things that need to be done to make that happen. But, you know, it's easy for politicians to say that the next lot of politicians will solve the problem. We need these politicians right now to solve the problem. We can't keep waiting for the next crop. That's what we've done for 30 years.
And that was Jeff Key, Forest and Birds Strategic Advisor. First Union has also criticised the plan, saying its energy emissions reduction relied too much on closing the Marsden Point oil refinery and it only outsources emissions overseas. Jared Abbott is the union's Secretary for Transport, Logistics and Manufacturing, and I spoke to him this morning.
Unambitious, to be honest. I mean, they've got a target to reach 7.7 megatons in reductions in emissions by 2027. And what they've proposed is essentially only about a 2.5 megaton reduction, which is about one third of what they've committed to. And then they seem to be crediting the closure of Marsden Point to try and prop that up to around 5 megatons, when in reality the closure of Marsden Point is actually going to increase emissions on the planet because they're just outsourcing it to another country. I guess for a government that's really promoted itself as being transformational and talked about climate change being a big issue for them, this is very underwhelming.
Can you tell us a bit more about how shutting down Marsden Point will just in return increase our emissions?
Well, at the moment, about 50% of fuel that's used for the transport fleet is already imported, and where that generally gets imported from is megafineries in Singapore. If you look at how those megafineries operate, their emissions that they're creating are around 18% through to 38% higher than what we're creating the same refining process in New Zealand. So by essentially shutting down a more efficient New Zealand refinery and then buying the fuel from a refinery that is less efficient in the way that it creates carbon, then you're increasing the amount of carbon. And then on top of that, there's other issues such as the increased burning of carbon through shipping, and also the fact that we're going to lose around 300 skilled staff, the exact skilled staff that this country would need to be able to get some proper bioenergy production off the ground in New Zealand. So it has a twofold effect. One is that we essentially offshore our emissions and in the process increase the amount of emissions on their planet. And secondly, we're going to lose the skilled staff that we need to actually be able to create alternative fuels in the future.
So basically, based on what you said, it's better to keep Marsden Point open.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the government even has talked a lot about just transitions and stuff like that. I mean, we're going to be losing literally dozens of millions of dollars every year in wages brought in through the Marsden Point refinery that goes into the economy. But also those skills are essential. If you look at what organisations like the Bioenergy Association have come out with, they're saying, look, it's going to be really hard for New Zealand to ever be able to create green energies as an alternative to fuel in New Zealand if we don't have those skilled staff. And obviously to attract staff from overseas, once we lose those staff, it's going to be a lot more expensive, which is even more of an impediment, I guess, to us moving away from fossil fuels. So yes, it doesn't make any sense at all to allow the refinery to close from an economic perspective, from a fuel security perspective, from a climate change perspective, and obviously future-proofing ourselves for the future in terms of actually moving to genuine green energies.
Okay. Other than Marsden Point, the discussion document also mentions quite a lot about transport, manufacturing, and forestry. Well, what are the impacts that this discussion document outlined could have on the relevant workers?
I think transport seems to be holding its weight in this, although I would make note that a lot of the things they've been accredited to achieving that 2.5 megaton reduction is actually stuff that isn't actually happening yet. It's stuff they're hoping will happen, but I think most of the gains are actually happening in transport. And, you know, I know they've talked about reducing the cost of public transport. I mean, if you look at the Climate Change Commission's recommendations, we actually have to double the amount of public transport being used. And in reality, in order to achieve that and influence people away from using cars in big cities like Auckland and Wellington and whatnot, what they're actually going to have to do is really incentivize people to use public transport. So we would really promote that, not just to increase the network, but also to make it accessible to people. And this is, it's such a necessary infrastructure. I mean, you will be able to increase productivity in general across the city by making public transport more accessible. So there is a huge economic gain to it that could pay off in the long run anyway. But we would like to see public transport essentially be free, and, you know, we want to see a transition to electric buses. We think the best way to achieve that is to move the public transport system out of the private sector, bring it back into public ownership, increase the amount of public transport, lower the cost of it so people are influenced to use it. And that's how we're going to reach those goals.
And that was Jared Abbott, First Unions' Secretary for Transport, Logistics and Manufacturing. This is the only the consultation document for New Zealand's emissions reduction plan to achieve net zero by 2050. The government's final plan will be released next May, and it was supposed to be this December, but the government pushed it by 5 months. Consultation on the plan is already open with the Ministry of Environment, and you can provide some feedback until 11:59 p.m. on November 24. And before our show comes to a close, and you can still let me know what you think about all the stories that was covered in today's show. The text number is 5395, or if you want to call me, the number is 309-3879.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei rā, and that's all for The Wire. That's all for the Thursday Wire for today, October 14. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero me kia mātou mō tēnei rā. Thanks to those who spoke to us today. We had Health Minister Andrew Little, Canterbury University's Professor Alex Tan, Greenpeace campaigner Christine Rose, Forest and Bird Strategic Advisor Jeff Key, and the First Unions' Secretary for Transport, Logistics and Manufacturing, Jared Abbott. E whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi poho. You're tuned into 95BFM right now. Sigrid is here with the 1 to 4 after this. So don't tune out just yet. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rawiki. I will be back next week. And until then, stay safe. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.